Job 27. We still have some wet folks wading through the rain. I'm going to have to get the elders to visit with my wife. I told her as we came up the building this morning that I needed to get in here and get things ready for my lesson, and would she please let me out under the portico? I didn't get very far. But I suppose maybe that explains why several of the husbands look bedraggled, wet, and their wives look nice and dry. But we're glad that you're here in this rain. I think I've told you my little poem before. To a football game or to a play, no amount of rain can keep us away. But let one drop of rain the sidewalk smirch, and it's too wet to go to church. And that's the way it works sometimes. We've got a little more than just a drop out there this morning. We're glad you're here. And we'll continue our study of Job this morning, and we'll probably have some coming in to join us as they work their way through this rather nasty rain. In chapter 27, we come to the last chapter in the opening discourses between Job and his friends. In the outline that we passed out in the beginning, we denominated this chapter as Job's conclusion. In chapter 28, at which we'll look maybe this morning, maybe next Lord's Day, but sometime, Lord willing, we'll be looking at an interlude between the discourses with the friends and the discourses with Elihu and God. Job 27, then Job continued his discourse and said, "As God lives, who has taken away my right, and the Almighty who has embittered my soul, for as long as life is in me, and the breath of God is in my nostrils, my lips certainly will not speak unjustly, nor will my tongue mutter deceit. Far be it from me that I should declare you right. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. I hold fast my righteousness and will not let it go. My heart does not reproach any of my days." In these verses, Job is doing something that we have seen him do all through his conversations, his dialogues with his friends. In these verses, Job very strongly asserts his innocence. Innocence we have seen not in the sense that he never sins at all, for he's spoken of the sins of his youth, but his innocence in relationship to the kind of burdens that he has had inflicted upon him. He certainly does not deserve, in his view, the depth of the suffering and the difficulties that have been inflicted upon him. Not only does he assert his innocence here, but he asserts his innocence in the very strongest of terms, because he swears by the very existence of God. He does not say, "as I live," based upon his life or his existence, but he takes it to the ultimate, "as God lives." And yet, even as he swears as to his innocence upon the very existence of God, we see some irony in what's going on here. Because at the same time that he is confessing, asserting his innocence, he is also accusing God, as it were, of leaving him in the lurch. "God has taken away my right. God has embittered my soul." Now, some folks read this and they conclude that at least at this point, Job is almost shaking his fist in the very face of God. But I think that's not the case. I think what Job is seeing here, and that which gives rise to his expression, is the fact that he sees a justice beyond what he perceives as injustice in this life. And it's It's up to God, as God lives. It is God's duty, it is God's obligation, as it were, to set some of these things right in the world of which this God, by whom he has sworn, is the sole maker and the sole owner. Everything in the world, the cattle upon a thousand hills, everybody in this world, everything belongs to God. It is his creation. And so God should set things right in the world. Question, does God do that? Has God done that? How seriously does God take this responsibility that Job is ascribing to him? Does Job have any concept? Don't think so. But does that mean that God has rejected that responsibility, that God has ignored it? I think you and I don't see how seriously God takes setting things right in the world until we get all the way over to the cross. And then we see that God takes very seriously setting things right in the world. That God takes very seriously taking care of the sin that besets man and that causes the difficulties and the problems that man possesses. So Job swears by God, he swears as to his innocence, but he recognizes that God is the source of his problems and his difficulty. Now, where is God as far as Job is concerned? God apparently is absent. He has called for God, but God has not appeared. Not only is God absent, but God is silent. Job has said, God, come in here and debate this thing with me. Come in here and I will take you to court and I will establish my innocence. But God not only is absent, God is silent. I think very much that Job had that same feeling that Jesus had on the cross. Why had God forsaken him? Because he has all through here felt forsaken of God. That's his quest, to find God and get back to the relationship that he enjoyed with God before the afflictions came, as Christ wanted to get back to his Father as he was with him before the world was and before his incarnation. So very much so, I think that attitude was there. But God, as far as Job is concerned, is absent. God is silent. And yet, what does Job maintain in the face of God's absence and God's silence? Are there not people? Maybe you have known people who, when they seek for God and do not find him when or as they think they ought to find him, conclude that God does not exist? Aren't there people, and have you not known people, who, when they cry out to hear the voice of God and God's voice is silent, not speaking when and as they think he ought to speak, they conclude that God does not exist? What is Job's reaction? How does Job react in the face of a God who is absent, in the face of a God who is silent? Does Job conclude that God does not exist? No. As I say, God does not speak when and as they think he ought to speak. And there's a big difference between that. A lot of us, you know, we think because God doesn't speak when and as we think he ought to, that he is not speaking. You're correct that he is. The problem is that we're not listening. But that's not our perception of it. We think listening and God is not speaking. But how does Job react? He does not conclude, as Bill suggests, that God does not exist, but he maintains his faith even in the face of an absent and silent God as he perceives it. For he begins here, as God lives. Now, it's easy, much easier for us to believe, isn't it? When God speaks, when and as we think he ought to speak. And when God appears, when and as we think he ought to appear. He has an attitude of questioning toward God. Because, as we'll see here in a minute, the debate between Job and his friends has never been over whether God is just, but the debate has been over the application of the justice of God in Job's particular circumstance. So yes, Job is embittered and Job has problems. But for us, it's easier, isn't it, to believe when God sort of behaves as we think he ought to behave. But when things don't go as we think they ought to go, and when instead of being elevated up here in the ethereal sky, instead of being elevated up here where the blessings pour out and the life is good and God is good and everything's going our way, how difficult is it for us to believe when we are down here somewhere in the muck and the mire? How easy is it for us to believe when we are in our knees on the mud, in the quicksand, and we seem to be sinking more rapidly than rescue seems to be in sight, and we feel that it's not going to be long before we start blubbing beneath the surface and our life is gone? And after all, why should you and I have to put up with that kind of foolishness? I don't remember, I don't know how many of you know Brother Dub Chisholm, who was at Memorial a number of years ago. Dub and Floy had an adopted daughter who was Jewish. And Dub said that as she grew older, she began to notice that her coloring, etc., wasn't like that of Dub and Floy and wasn't like a lot of the other kids around, and so she began to inquire about that. And Dub sat down with her one evening and started explaining to her her ancestry. And he said, you know, I went back and I talked to her about Abraham and how great Abraham was and Isaac and Jacob, and I talked to him about how wonderful it was that these were the people of God, and that was a part of her ancestry. And he said, about the time I got through, Floyd came in and said, it's time to go to bed. And the daughter looked up and said, doesn't she know who I am? Deb had done a very good job of explaining her ancestry and who she was. And who is this woman think she is to be ordering me around? I mean, I am a child of Abraham. Well, question. Doesn't God know who we are? We are the children of the King. If we are the children of the King, then what are we doing down here in all of this muck and mire? Turn to Hebrews, chapter 2, verse 9. But we do see him who has been made for a little while lower than the angels, namely Jesus, because of the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. For it was fitting for him, for whom are all things, and through whom are all things, in bringing many sons to glory, to perfect the author of their salvation through suffering. Jesus was the child of the King. He was the unique child of the King. For God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten, unique, only one of His kind. And yet, this one who was God, who was the Son of God, spent His time in the muck and the mire before He was elevated to glory. Turn back to Ephesians chapter 2. But God, verse 4, being rich in mercy because of His great love with which He loved us, even when we were dead in our transgressions, made us alive together with Christ. By grace you have been saved, and raised us up with Him, and seated us with Him in the heavenly places in Christ Jesus. And sometimes, even as the children of the King, we wind up on our knees in the muck and the mire. But you and I should never forget who we are. And that even when we are on our knees in the muck and the mire and the suffering and the sorrows, that we are still God's children, we are still the brethren of Jesus Christ. And that though we perhaps cannot see it clearly, we still sit on the throne, because as His children, we've been raised to sit up with Christ in the heavenly places. Job maintained his faith. Even in all of the difficulties, he still believed that God lived. Can you and I maintain our faith in the face of such difficulties? Job was determined to maintain his innocence. He would not declare his friends to be correct in their charges. Till I die, I will not put away my contention that I am spiritually whole before God. I will not put my integrity from me. Now, we're familiar with that word integrity. Some of you engineers, if you have a whole number, what's it called? A what? An integer. If you have separate ingredients for something you're cooking, if you have separate factions that you're trying to get together, what's that called? You want to make it the diverse parts a whole. Integrate. Integer, a whole number. Integrate, wholeness out of separate parts. If you have something that is an essential part of the whole, what's it called? It's an integral part of it. So Job says, I maintain my wholeness. I maintain my spiritual wholeness before God. I will maintain my integrity. And I will not let my neighbors, my friends, take my integrity from me as long as I'm alive. I will hold fast my righteousness and will not let it go. My heart does not reproach any of my days. In verses 7 to 23, we reach the part that we were talking about, just alluded to earlier, where Job affirms the justice of God. And here we need to remember, as I said, that the disagreement between Job and his friends has not been so much over whether God is just, but the application of the justice of God in a particular situation, and especially here in Job's situation. May my enemy be as the wicked, and my opponent, my friends, those are his opponents now, as the unjust. And this seems to be an imprecation more than it seems to be a statement of fact. Job is discussing here that the inevitable lot of the wicked is going to be punishment. And it's based upon, I think, his abhorrence of evil and his perception of his righteousness as he has just described it. My enemy may be as the wicked, my opponent as the unjust. Why does Job want these things to fall on his friends? You remember some time ago, we reminded you that in the Old Testament, the punishment for a false accuser was to receive the punishment that the one falsely accused was to have received. Job has been falsely accused. I will not give in to you. I will never say that you are right. I will maintain my integrity, though I die. You have falsely accused me, so everything that you've been saying about me is something that is due unto you. For what is the hope of the godless when he's cut off? When God requires his life. The godless may gain by violence in his lifetime, but when God cuts him off and brings his life to a conclusion, what's his gain? What's his hope? Not any. Not any. He is lonely and isolated. And that's the way death is. It is always lonely and isolated. Have you ever noticed that you get up more courage when you're with a crowd? I mean, I never was afraid of the biggest fella if I had four or five guys with me. Let me be alone, and it was a different story. Then I wished that God had made my feet a little bit faster so I could get away from there a little bit quicker. But I won't have to cross Jordan alone. And that's true if we cross it with Jesus Christ. That is not true from the human standpoint. And that's the song looked to crossing Jordan with Jesus. We can do a number of things in a crowd. We can go to a football game in a crowd. We can go to eat in a crowd. But we can't die in a crowd. Now, we may die at the same time that others die. Automobile accident, plane crash, 60 killed, 180 killed. But everybody dies alone. Nobody can go into that valley with you. Nobody can hold your hand as you slip away into it and hold you back. Every person, doesn't make a difference how many friends you may have around you. And many of us have been with friends when they died. They still die alone. It is a moment of isolation. It's a moment of loneliness. And it doesn't make any difference how rich you are, how fine your house is, what kind of sarcophagus you're going to be reposed. You're just going to die alone. For what is the hope of the godless when he's cut off, when God requires his life, everything he's given his life to, everything he's given his life for, all of the friends who have surrounded him with merriment and engaged with him in sin are going to be gone. Will God hear his cry when distress comes upon him? Will he take delight in the Almighty? Will he call on God at all times? Such a person, Job tells us, has forfeited all right to call upon God. how different that is from Job. Job confidently called upon God any number of times we have seen, and we'll see some more. As a matter of fact, one contrast that you may note between Job and his friends is that Job often and confidently called upon God, and his friends never do. That's a big difference between Job and his friends. I will instruct you in the power of God. What is the Almighty? What is with the Almighty? I will not conceal. Behold, all of you have seen it. Why then do you act foolishly? What's happened here? I will instruct you in the power of God. Why did Job's friends come? What were they there for? Job, we're going to tell you about God. We're going to tell you what's wrong with you. And we're going to tell you why God is dealing with you the way that He is. What has happened here is that the student has become the teacher. And Job says, now listen to me, gentlemen. I'm going to teach you. I'm going to tell you about the power of God and the ways of God, that which is with God, I will not conceal from you. Now, what do you think the reaction of Job's friends was to that? Who in the world does this fella covered with boils bursting with pus think he is? I have been to church any number of times, they might say, and never ever have I seen a pulpit that was an ash heap. And here is this guy covered with pustules sitting on an ash heap for a pulpit who's going to tell us about God. Can you think of a more unlikely pulpit from which to declare the nature of God? I can. It's called Calvary. When one covered with stripes not his own saliva running down his face over bruises inflicted by cruel blows declared to you and me the nature of God and the love of God. And yes, the wrath of God against sin. I will declare to you, Job said, the power of God. And that power was declared to us at Calvary. 1 Corinthians 1:18. The word of the cross. Paul said, I'll declare to you. To those that don't believe, it's foolishness. But to those who believe, he said, it is the power of God. I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, Paul said. For it is the power of God to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith unto faith. As it is written, the just shall live by faith. Job, from his pulpit of ashes, said, I'll tell you about the power of God. And to the extent he was able, so he did. That from the pulpit of Calvary, Jesus Christ declared unto us the true power and the true glory of God, and opened up the way that we might move from the ash heap to the riches of heaven. I will instruct you in the power of God. What is with the Almighty, I will not conceal. Behold, all of you have seen it. Why then do you act foolishly? Isn't that a good question for those who have seen the cross and not been cleansed by its flowing blood? Don't need any comment on that, do we? Verses 13 to 23, Job talks about the portion of the wicked man. This is the portion of a wicked man from God, and the inheritance which tyrants receive from the Almighty. Though his sons are many, they are destined for the sword, and his descendants will not be satisfied with bread. Numerous children were thought to be a great blessing. But this man's children are heirs for destruction. They're going to be destroyed. He may have some survivors from the sword, but the plague will get them. His survivors will be buried because of the plague, and their widows will not be able to weep. Once the family is destroyed, his riches are going to follow. Though he piles up silver like dust and prepares garments as plentiful as the clay, he may prepare it, but the just will wear it, and the innocent will divide the silver. His house is going to be destroyed. He has built his house like the spider's web. Some translations say the moth. But later translations say the spider's web, the moth does not build a house. But the spider's web is fragile, easily destroyed, or is a hut which the watchman has made. His riches disappear, he lies down rich, but never again. He opens his eyes, and it is no more. He has numerous fears, day and night. Terrors overtake him like a flood. A tempest steals him away in the night. He will be destroyed by the velocity of wind and the searing heat. The east wind, which is a very hot and strong wind, carries him away, and he is gone, for it whirls him away from his place. For it, and some translations here say God, the subject is assumed, it is not spoken, as far as the Hebrew is concerned, will hurl at him without sparing. Whatever the subject is, the description is very clear. The individual is not going to be spared. He'll try to be spared. He'll surely try to flee from its power. Men will clap their hands at him and will hiss from his place. Men are glad that they are gone. It doesn't make any difference how big the funeral is for the wicked man. People may show up. for whatever reasons they show up. But inwardly, they're clapping because he is dead. They're glad. They're delighted that he and his wickedness have departed this world. Nobody mourns him, except maybe those who are paid, and nobody misses him. Delighted that his evil is no more. Thus ends Job's conclusion. Next Lord's Day morning, we'll look at the interlude. The first bell is rung, so we'll not start on that this morning. You have any questions or comments? It went completely over their head. We will see Elihu, if he'll behave properly and bring sacrifices, get interceded for. Any other comments or questions? They may take a second thought. Most of us would probably just say, well, we're still right. He's just lucky. He joined up with a new band of thieves. But certainly it should make us take a second look. However, most of us are not good second lookers. We've got our minds made up. We don't want to be confused with the facts. Any other comments or questions? Appreciate your presence on this very rainy Sunday morning. Appreciate your attention and the contributions you made to the class.